Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Colorado Court of Appeals is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, council and parties. Welcome to Division 2 of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for oral argument this afternoon. The first is Saeed versus Old Republic. Council President Reddy.
Yes, Your Honor. Present at council table is Mr. Sharaf Ghani.
All right, thank you. Our second case is People versus Green. Our council president Reddy in that case.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, we'll take that case second. Let me briefly review the ground rules for those of you who may not have argued here before. These cases are set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system controlled by our bailiff over here, which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light will come on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light will come on. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please. Your voice will not be picked up well by the microphone if you stray from it. We have read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument and omit a discussion of the facts, that's fine. We will, however, give you leave to turn and face the audience and give the audience a brief recap of the facts of the case. Please limit your time to about 2 minutes, just to give them a brief overview in case they've not read the particular briefs as yet. We also would like to invite counsel after the arguments to stay and talk with the students. They will have some questions for you on how you prepare, what kinds of things you look to try and do during oral argument and the like. If your schedules will not permit, we understand that. We will take a brief 15-minute recess after the arguments, and you'll have an opportunity to speak candidly with the students. We'll then return, and you're welcome to leave at that time or stay as you wish. All right? We're ready for argument in Saeed versus Old Republic. And counsel, if you'd like to tell the audience what your case is about, feel free to do that.
Okay. Turn the microphone off here. Back in the summer of 2009, Mr. Saeed became a cab driver for Yellow Cab. As part of that process, he signed an independent contractor which said that he was an independent contractor and not entitled to workers' compensation coverage or something like it. About 10 days later, he was involved in a very serious collision and was badly injured. He was hospitalized and in a rehabilitation home for about 45 days. As he recovered, he obtained counsel, and we requested things such as workers' compensation coverage or its equivalent, and we requested uninsured motorist coverage. Uninsured motorist coverage is coverage that basically says that if you are hit by someone who doesn't have enough coverage, that the uninsured motorist carrier or the insurance company will pay for the things that the person at fault for the injuries should have paid for if they had had sufficient insurance. In this case, in the trial court, there were a number of parties sued. The parties in this appeal are just Mr. Saeed and an insurer called Old Republic. Old Republic provided workers' compensation insurance coverage for the cab company and provided liability coverage for Mr. Saeed and the cab company. As part of the law, we argue that Mr. Saeed, when he was offered liability coverage, should have been offered uninsured motorist coverage in an amount equal to liability. And since he was not given the opportunity to accept or reject that coverage in a knowing way. And so the policy should be changed or reformed to provide coverage that the law would otherwise have required, or if there had been a proper offer of UM coverage, and that would have been UM coverage and liability coverage in the same amount. So that way he could have been compensated for his injuries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel. Go right ahead. We'll have Mr. Lebsack speak after when he has an opportunity to argue. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I will go directly to the heart of this appeal. The question is whether a yellow cab, the cab company in this case, could be an agent for Old Republic Insurance in connection with the sale of insurance. If Yellow Cab was an agent, then its knowledge and its misrepresentations are the misrepresentations and knowledge of Old Republic. Yellow Cab sold liability insurance to drivers such as Mr. Saeed. Old Republic, when it offered this coverage, was also obligated to make an offer of uninsured or UM coverage. Mr. Saeed was supposed to be an independent contractor. That's important because he wasn't an employee just covered under a company policy. Instead, he paid money to Yellow Cab, who in turn paid money to Old Republic for this liability coverage. He signed an independent contractor agreement.
Excuse me, counsel. Is there anything in the record about whether Yellow Cab retained any of those monies that Mr. Saeed paid to them?
No, Your Honor. We didn't get any discovery.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. As that agreement reflects, in return for, as the independent contractor agreement reflects, Yellow Cab furnished liability coverage. It turns out that the word furnishing, as used in the independent contractor agreement, meant that money paid by drivers such as Mr. Saeed resulted in coverage for Mr. Saeed as required by Colorado law. The coverage was not issued by Yellow Cab, it was issued by Old Republic. We never got to a point of determining the terms and conditions of that policy, or even whether the cab drivers were considered additional named insureds.
Well, counsel, we did have the insurance policy in the record, and you did not object to consideration of that policy in the court below.
That I did not object. That is true. And the policy is that was there. That is true. But do we know if that's the entire policy? I don't know. I did argue that the arguments of Yellow Cab were arguments of fact and in the court below and should not be considered. I did not say I formally object and move to strike.
Well, in fact, you relied on those same documents in your response, and in fact, in this court, you asked us to look at them. So you can't exactly complain that, at least now, that the insurance company attached those documents to its motion, can you?
I don't complain that they attached it to their motion. I do complain that I didn't have the opportunity to get all the documents about who were the named insureds.
Well, the insurance agreement was produced.
Yes, sir.
It was attached. So what basis, consistent with Rule 11, would you have for saying there might be another policy?
I'm not saying there's another policy, nor I'm saying that there would be a different, there would be additional documents pertaining to the policy, such as endorsements or certificates of coverage that might say Mr. Saeed was an additional insured.
All right, but that would make him a named insured.
Additional named insured, yes.
But the portion of the policy that identifies specifically the named insured is in the record, and your client is not the named insured.
Well,
You're saying there might be another portion of the policy?
There might be other documents relating to the policy. Yes, Your Honor. I frequently am involved in insurance litigation where it turns out that there are many documents relating to a policy that end up being incorporated into it.
What is your theory of agency? What is your legal theory of agency here? Is it that Yellow Cab was a broker, producer? Is it this statutory theory? Is there something else?
There are two ways that the Yellow Cab could be an agent. One is the producer statute, but we're faced with the problem that the producer statute only applies to persons who sell to members of the general public. So the next question is, can Yellow Cab be an agent? And the answer is yes. There is no law that's been cited to this court by either side saying that the law of agency no longer applies. And so our theory is that by acting on behalf of another here, Yellow Cab was an agent. And certainly there's a question of fact concerning that. And the pre-statute cases all discuss agency of the person selling the insurance as a question of fact.
So your theory here is that Yellow Cab acted as the agent for Old Republic and should have required Old Republic to offer your client uninsured motorist coverage?
No, Your Honor. My theory is that that Old Republic, when the agent sold insurance and offered liability coverage, they also should have offered on behalf of Old Republic uninsured motorist coverage.
So that goes to both Yellow Cab and Old Republic, or just Yellow Cab?
Well, it goes to Old Republic for the purposes of this appeal, because Yellow Cab is not a party to this appeal.
All right, but you're relying on the Passamano case, correct?
Yes.
All right. In Passamano, the court looked at an arrangement between a rental car agency and its customer. And what the court said was that in that case, because of the agreement between the rental car agency and the customer, that the rental car agency became the insurer. And as the insurer, it had to offer uninsured motorist coverage. But you're not seeking to reform the independent contractor agreement here. You want to reform the insurer's contract with Yellow Cab. That's not what Passamano did.
Oh, I don't, Your Honor, I would suggest to the court that Passamano did not address the question of agency. Passamano involved two separate situations. There was the Kent lawsuit and the Passamano lawsuit. And in that case, Travelers insured the rental car agency, and then there was a contract between Passamano and the rental agency. And in Kent, the rental agency was self-insured. The issue did not come up concerning agency in the appeal, and I went through it very carefully. And apparently there was no need to bring it up in that situation because there were sufficient deep pockets on behalf of the rental agency. So that issue was not determined by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court in that case. So Yellow Cab here was alleged to have sold insurance for Old Republic. That's in the complaint. And it is said that since Yellow Cab was not a producer, there's no basis to contend that Yellow Cab was acting on behalf of Old Republic. But then there's the agency question that we discussed. And this Yellow Cab agency said, here, this is what we'll give you. We will take your money, and in return, we will get you insurance through Old Republic. They were not offering insurance through themselves. Therefore, they were acting as an agent. So they represented themselves as obtaining insurance. They took money, and then they supplied insurance from a third party. They acted like an agent in all regards. The next issue is whether Yellow Cab was selling insurance. And certainly in Passamano, it was made clear that offering something pursuant to contract can be selling insurance. The difference, of course, is that they were doing it for Old Republic, not for themselves. The purpose of the UM statute is to provide members of the driving public with an opportunity to make an informed decision. I argued that Yellow Cab was not a member of the driving public, and indeed they're not. Yellow Cab, though it rejected UM coverage, was not rejecting coverage on behalf of anyone such as Mr. Saeed at that time. Indeed, they had never met at that moment when Yellow Cab apparently rejected uninsured motorist coverage.
Counsel, but unlike the rental car situation in which there is no vicarious liability, with taxi companies, there is vicarious liability, and that's why taxi companies take out this kind of liability insurance. That point was made by the concurrence in Passamano in distinguishing taxi companies from car rental agencies. In other words, the taxi company here had a reason for insuring itself, which it did through its policy with Old Republic.
Well, that's
whereas in the rental car situation, there was no such purpose, and indeed, the concurrence makes the point that any benefit to the employees, so the drivers, in the taxi situation is incidental. It's not the purpose of the policy.
I would disagree with the last point that you made, that the cab company argues that the benefit to the drivers is incidental. Everything else I, of course, agree with. It's just that the cab driver needs to insure themselves to protect themselves against their own careless acts. Everyone makes mistakes. And so that is just one reason. Certainly the cab company benefited here, but so did the cab driver. And to ignore that reality, would, I think, would be a mistake. As this court and others have pointed out, liability coverage and UM coverage should be coextensive. And the liability coverage here covered Mr. Saeed because it was furnished, he was furnished coverage required by law, which in this case required that he be insured against his own negligent acts up to the minimum amount required by the PUC, which is well above the $25,000 level. How difficult would it have been to give these drivers a choice to get this coverage? The answer is not very difficult at all. It's a three-line kind of thing that is used where it says this is uninsured motorist, this is what it does, and this is what you need to consider. Now, the other point I want to jump to, I see my light is yellow already, is the summary judgment versus motion to dismiss. The court relied on defendant's exhibit B to say the Yellow Cab was the named insured. And the court said that the policy was, quote, central to the complaint. Now, it wasn't named attached to the complaint. We don't have all the documents, perhaps, relating to it. And to allow a dismissal at this point as a dismissal without summary judgment takes the concept of going something being central to the complaint too far. My final argument has to do with the Consumer Protection Act and conspiracy. If there is agency, then there is a misrepresentation against by Yellow Cab on behalf of Old Republic, such as you're not entitled to workers' compensation coverage. And there's a conspiracy to commit an unlawful act, which is to make misrepresentations in violation of that act. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of the time I have left, which may be very little.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lebsack, if you'd like to face the audience and give them a brief recap of the case from your viewpoint.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Lebsack. I represent Old Republic Insurance Company. As you heard from Mr. Frankel, we issued a liability insurance policy to Yellow Cab. And liability insurance is the kind of insurance that protects you if you do something negligent and you get sued and something damage. So it doesn't actually pay you any benefits, it just protects you if somebody else sues you. So there's a Colorado statute that says that every liability insurance policy, every auto liability insurance policy, you must offer the named insurer, that's a key term for purposes of this case, you must offer the named insurer the right to buy what's called uninsured motorist coverage. And uninsured motorist coverage is if you get hit by somebody who doesn't have insurance, or there's another variation of it, if the other person has a very small amount of insurance and your damages are very expensive, then that coverage, that uninsured motorist coverage, will pay you what you should have been able to collect on the other hand. But that is optional. You don't have to buy it. You can reject it if you want. The statute says the insurance company has to offer it, and the named insurer makes a selection to take it or not. And if you don't take it, the insured has to do it right. And so what we claim in this case, we've got a document signed by Yellow Cab saying we reject it. And so we're taking the position that the policy did not include that because the named insurer, Yellow Cab, signed a document saying we reject it.
May it please the court, I'm John Lebsack. I represent Old Republic Insurance. And I have to begin by stating that we have a disagreement on what I think the heart of the appeal is. What Mr. Frankel said is the heart of the appeal is the agency issue. And I submit that it doesn't matter one way or the other for the ultimate outcome, because the heart of this appeal is compliance with the statute regarding uninsured motors, 10-4609. So to just put that in context and explain why I think that's the heart of the case and the agency issue is not determinative. The complaint refers to a number of different insurance coverages. Old Republic is in this case only because we issued the liability policy to Yellow Cab. There are other coverages referred to in the complaint, and the other defendants that are involved with those other coverages are not involved in this appeal. Those are the so-called work comp or similar related coverages. So those issues about whether Colorado Cab made a misrepresentation about workers' compensation, whether Colorado Cab said something about, well, we've got similar coverage to workers' comp, that's not involved in this case.
Mr. Lebsack, let me ask you a quick question.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you.
But
is Old Republic involved in the workers' compensation insurance issue at all?
It is not. And if you go through the complaint, I can give you paragraph 8, record page 192, identifies who Old Republic is. It gives our address. It says Old Republic provides liability and underinsured motorist insurance to Yellow Cab and plaintiff. And I think there's another allegation in the complaint that makes it clear that we were involved in issuing a liability insurance policy only. So if there's allegations involving workers' comp. That's not us. The workers' comp defendants are National Union Fire, Chartist Claims, and the issue there is that there was no workers' comp. I'm just going to digress for a second. Yeah, there was no workers' comp.
I don't want to take up your time on that.
And so the question is, did Colorado CAB make some misstatements about workers' compensation? And that's the side of the case that stayed at the trial court. Okay. And we're not involved with that.
All right, Mr. Lipson, I want to get back to the sufficiency point because the complaint alleges that the cab company was the agent or producer. It's an or. And counsel has made clear that they seem to be relying on some kind of a general common law agency theory in addition to the statutory producer theory, which they concede is problematic. Given that this is a motion to dismiss, in which we have to accept the factual allegations as true, why don't we have to accept as true that the cab company was Old Republic's agent?
I don't disagree that you have to accept the factual allegation as true. What I disagree with is the allegation that they were a producer and that they meet the statutory definition. But let me just cut right to the chase on this agency thing. Just imagine the scenario where what Colorado CAB is alleged to have done about UM coverage, that we said that. So just, you know, and substitute in the complaint where it says Colorado CAB made a misstatement as to uninsured motorists. Just put in Old Republic did that. It doesn't change the outcome. And the reason it doesn't is because what the statute says, 10-4609, is that there is one duty on a liability insurer in regard to UM. And that is you offer the named insured the coverage, the optional coverage. The named insured, the statute uses that term, and if the insured, the named insured rejects it, it has to be in writing. So if you just take it to the logical extreme and assume that this agency issue, you know, is a valid issue, then the question is, did Colorado CAB say something that creates liability for us if they were acting for us and it's imputed to us? No, they didn't. So if you look at the complaint, and we've identified these portions, but let me just be specific. Paragraph 39 of the complaint says that Colorado CAB and Old Republic led Mr. Saeed to believe he wasn't entitled to an offer of UM coverage. So underlying that allegation is, was he entitled to an offer of UM coverage? No, he's not the named insured. The document, which is in the record, and there's no question of, or no dispute as to the authenticity of that document, is that the named insured is Colorado CAB, and they rejected UM coverage. So
Mr. Levesque, can I ask you to digress a moment? Based on Passamano and other cases that have said that if an insurance policy doesn't comply with a statutory requirement, it can be reformed,
yes,
to provide the necessary coverage. As I understand the theory here, it is that Mr. Saeed should have been the named insured, not Yellow Cab, relying on the Passamano case to say when you contract, as he did here, to essentially rent a car from Yellow Cab, and you get a representation from Yellow Cab that here's your liability policy, that means that you should consider him a named insured. So if that's true, if we have to accept that is true, doesn't that create a conflict with the document you tendered saying only Yellow Cab is a named insured?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think it's the point that Judge Jones was making earlier, which is that Passamano talked about the rental car agreement. So in this case, we've got two contracts. We've got the independent contractor agreement between Mr. Saeed and Yellow Cab, and then we've got a separate contract, which is the insurance contract between Old Republic and Yellow Cab. So what Passamano is talking about is the rental car contract between the person who's taking the rental car and Budget or Avis or whoever. And what Passamano says is that rental car contract should be considered an insurance policy. And if it doesn't, if you didn't offer the UM at the time of renting that, then it's going to be reformed into that rental car contract. But what we've got, I'm Old Republic, I'm over here, and I'm not involved in that you know, the independent contractor agreement. So if you're going to reform something which is not in the complaint, you know, what they talk with the complaint talks about reforming the old Republic policy, but they're, you know, what Passamana would let you do is reform the independent contractor agreement and not get over to the liability insurance.
Well, isn't that where the agency theory comes in? Isn't he saying that Yellow Cab is acting as the agent for Old Republic, and therefore, if you reform the contract between Yellow Cab and Mr. Saeed, that implicates Old Republic? Now, I'm not saying that that's what the facts will show.
Yeah, Your Honor, I disagree on the agency point. Okay. I think that what the complaint is alleging is that when Colorado Cab said something, that they were acting as an agent. I don't think the complaint says that they should be deemed to stand in the shoes of the company issuing the insurance policy. So this whole agency idea, you can't bootstrap that into putting Colorado Cab in the position of issuing an insurance policy. I mean, you can't put Colorado Cab in the shoes of having some responsibility to modify the policy that it bought. If Colorado Cab has any responsibility for reformation, it, under Passamana, it would only be for the independent contract agreement. So the agency theory that's in the complaint is only for these alleged misrepresentations and misstatements of, you know, he's not entitled to an offer. So I think that is where the agency theory is applied.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Lebsack. Is there anything in the amended complaint that, if taken as true, would indicate that Old Republic held Yellow Cab out as its agent?
No.
Instead of being the other way around, as you just explained about Yellow Cab saying something and plaintiff saying, well, that means Yellow Cab was an agent.
No, I don't believe there is anything that Old Republic held out Colorado Cab as an agent.
Or conducted itself in any manner.
No,
that would indicate it was recognizing Yellow Cab as its agent.
No. What the complaint says is, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt on, you know, what they've alleged is that Old Republic, or it actually Colorado Cab and Old Republic said XYZ. And for example, this is paragraph 20 of the complaint. Colorado Cab acted as an agent and insurance producer for Old Republic, which provided liability insurance. Neither Old Republic nor Colorado Cab offered Mr. Saeed UM coverage. That's paragraph 18. So there's no allegation in here that we held out Colorado Cab, but there are allegations that Colorado Cab and Old Republic made some kind of a statement. But I'm getting back to the point I made a minute ago, which is, okay, accept that is true. What is the statement that we and Colorado Cab allegedly made? Well, one of them is that Mr. Saeed is not entitled to an offer of UM coverage. That is a true legal statement. He's not the named insured, and so he's not entitled to an offer. The statute says you offer the named insured the option to buy the coverage, and the record is clear that Yellow Cab is.
So let me ask you, just so I am getting this correctly, I think, with regard to paragraph 39, what you're saying is, even if we take that as being true, it doesn't matter, because he is in fact not the named insured.
Correct. I'll focus on paragraph 39 because I think it's representative of the other paragraphs that make the same kind of allegation. And since I'm on tape, it's 39, 52, and 59. That's the same type of thing. 39, I'll read it in its entirety. At all times relevant, Colorado Cab and Old Republic led Mr. Saeed and others to believe that they were not entitled to an offer of uninsured motorist coverage. That underlying statement that led him to believe that he's not entitled, that is a correct statement of Colorado law. If he's not the named insured, then he's not entitled to the offer.
Well, counsel, as I understand their argument, they're saying that Mr. Saeed and the other driver should have been named as insureds or should be regarded as the named insureds because it, after all, is their actions that are being insured against. So they really are the insured parties.
There is no basis in the statute or any other aspect of Colorado law that I'm aware to consider other people to be named insureds. So there are, I mean, we've had situations in the year that I'm sure the court is familiar with where there are additional insureds that are added on. But the point in this case is to focus on what this statute means and what this statute requires. And this statute says the named insured shall be offered. So there is nothing in the complaint that says he should have been another named insured. What's in the complaint is that Colorado Cab and Old Republic led him to believe that he was not entitled to an offer. So there's nothing in here where he claims to be an additional insured. If you look in the contract, the independent contractor agreement, which is in the record, there's nothing at all about that. What it talks about is that Yellow Cab will procure liability insurance, which it did. So there's nothing in there that, similarity to construction agreements, for example, where the subcontractor agreement will say, you subcontractor shall go out and buy insurance, naming us the general contractor as an additional insured, that type of thing. That's not here. Plus, the statute is what controls, and the statute says the named insured. So there's no allegation in the complaint that there's any other named insured, and there's nothing in the record to support that. So let me just carry on to paragraph 52. Old Republic and Colorado Cab conspired to deny Mr. Saeed UM benefits. Well, he's not entitled to UM benefits because it's not in the policy. So the allegation that Colorado Cab and Old Republic did something fails because what the allegation is not the law of Colorado. Paragraph 59, Colorado Cab on behalf of Old Republic supplied false information to Mr. Saeed that he was entitled to UM benefits. Well, he's not entitled to UM benefits because there's no UM in the policy. So because Old Republic complied with the statute and the statute controls, there's no UM coverage here, and the claims were properly dismissed.
Thank you.
I guess I have time for one sentence. If you allow Old Republic and Yellow Cab to determine who is the named insured, you circumvent the purpose of the statute. The named insured should be the member of the driving public. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. We'll ask counsel at this point to take a seat in the audience and the counsel for People versus Green to come forward. When you're ready, please feel free to address the audience and give them a brief recap of the case.
Good afternoon. My name is Rebecca Frayray. I'm an attorney with the Colorado Public Attorney's Office. And so the appeal that I will be arguing is a criminal case. And in this case, my client, Jeffrey Green, was charged with second-degree burglary, first-degree criminal trespass, criminal mischief, harassment, and unlawful sexual contact. He went to trial, and he was convicted of the trespass charge, and he was acquitted of all the other charges. He was later, in separate proceeding, adjudicated to be an habitual criminal for his prior felony convictions, and the trial court sentenced him to 12 years in the Department of Corrections for his conviction trespass. In this case, basically what happened, there's three characters. Here's my client. There's the victim in the case, who is a woman who had met about a month earlier. And there's a mutual friend of theirs, DJ. My client and the victim had been dating. He lived in Colorado Springs, she lived in Denver. He had been out a couple of occasions to spend weekends with her. They had an intimate relationship. They made plans in July 2007 for him to come on for a weekend for a first-time birthday. And she made arrangements to pick him up at the bus station. DJ had been staying at her house for about 3 days at the time that they went to the apartment. He was on the house with his girlfriend. He had his own set of keys to the victim's house. And on the date of the events in this case, he had been using the victim's car. So he arrives in Denver. They go back to the victim's house. He brought his duffel bags with him, which was a surprise, with his job down in Colorado Springs. He was now moving to Denver, and she was a little upset about that. And she worked at a bar and restaurant, and DJ and my client drank beer, smoked cigarettes that afternoon, and went to the bar with her. Later on, there was an argument between my client and the victim at the bar, and she sent a friend of hers over to her house to get my client's duffel bags and bring them back to the bar and said, you know, I can't talk to you ever again. He left the bar, and then over the course of about the next 7 hours, they communicated with each other via text message. DJ was doing a lot of communicating, but my client didn't know that. When the detectives came up, then later on that night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, the victim got off work and was getting undressed and ready for bed when she heard my client say, can we just talk? She then asked, what are you doing here? And she said, DJ, let me in. And so she called DJ. DJ said, no, I didn't plan to call the police. And so she called the police. She told my client to leave. He was later arrested and showed the police the same thing. DJ, let me in. We had this argument. So the next day when the detectives investigated, she very much downplayed this relationship that she had with my client. She didn't tell the detective that they had an intimate relationship. She testified at trial that that first he heard of that was during her trial testimony. She lied to the responding officers and said, my client had never been to her house before, but they said, you know, yeah, he heard that before. So the issue in this case on appeal is it deals with whether DJ had the legal right to let him. During the jury instruction conference, the defense counsel asked for a specific legal instruction instructing the jury on the law concerning possessory interests of property, and the court rejected that instruction. Then during deliberations, the jury sent out a question asking whether, you know, if DJ let him in, since he had his own set of keys, would this still be an unlawful entry, even though Nikki, the victim, didn't give permission? And so defense counsel again requested that the jury be instructed on this law of possessory interest, and the court just referred the jury back to the instructions. So that's going to be the issue that I'm going to put in today.
Thank you.
Your Honors, good afternoon. Rebecca Frayray, Deputy State Public Defender, 20010. I'm going to get right into the first issue in my brief, which is really two issues, the jury instruction issue and then the jury question issue. And I kind of want to start with the standard of review because there was a little disagreement in the briefs about that. It's the state's position that it's an abuse of discretion standard. It's my position that it's de novo. You know, I think there's kind of authority for both. But when I think of an abuse of discretion standard, I think of the court affirmatively doing something and then this court reviewing that decision, and if it's supported by the record, you know, that's okay. In this case, the judge didn't do something. He didn't give the instruction that was offered by the defense. And so I think under the Zukowski case that I cited, and even there was a case last Thursday that reaffirmed this, that a reviewing court should look at the jury instructions as a whole de novo to determine whether under the facts of this particular case they sufficiently instruct the jury on the law of the case. And I think there has to be a de novo review in order for you to determine whether the court rejecting that instruction was legally erroneous. So I still maintain that it's a de novo review, and that if the jury instructions didn't adequately inform the jury, which is my position, they weren't adequately informed on the law, then reversible error occurs. The state didn't address the standard of reversal. It's my position that under the Montoya case, it should be a constitutional harmless error review, because this particular requested instruction was relevant to an element, the unlawful entry element of, well, the burglary and the trespass statute. Prosecution had the burden of proving that element beyond a reasonable doubt, and since they were never informed that a person with possessory interest can grant permission to enter, that unfairly lowered the prosecution's burden of proof and implicated Mr. Green's right to a fair trial, as well as his constitutional right to present a defense. So that's why I think constitutional harmless error applies. So the defense of permission raises two issues: the factual question about whether there's facts in the record to show permission, but it also raises the second legal question, who can give authorization to enter? And that's why we requested the instruction. The court, interestingly, it rejected the instruction on two grounds. The first was he believed that the instructions as they existed adequately informed the jury on the law, and that's the definition of unlawful entry, I think, combined with the theory of the case instruction, which said it was Mr. Green's theory, his defense was permission to enter. But then the court acknowledged that, yeah, there are facts in the record, you could argue either way, that one or both could have granted permission. So he didn't reject it on a factual basis, which is what the state bases its argument on. But the court then also rejects the instruction because he says it's not a correct statement of the law. And I think that is a legal error, because I think the cases that defense counsel cited to the trial court, the cases that I put in my brief, show that this rejected instruction clearly is the law. Permission is a defense to the element of unlawful entry. Previously granted permission to enter premises has to be withdrawn for an entry to be unlawful. This particular case raised that, because there was undisputed evidence that she invited my client, the victim invited my client to be there. And the factual dispute then was that permission withdrawn? And I think the jury, at least at the jury instruction conference portion, we were trying to get an instruction on the whole law about permission. We hadn't committed to arguing whether it was the victim that gave permission to enter or DJ that gave permission to enter at the jury instruction conference. Now, the question more narrowly focused that legal question, but the jury instruction conference, we didn't commit one way or the other.
Ms. Perry, the evidence was also unrebutted that the victim told the defendant, I never want to see you again, and had somebody else go to her apartment and get his stuff out of there. What evidence was there that she gave him permission to?
Well, first of all, what she stated in her testimony was that I don't want to see you again. She says, I don't ever want to talk to you again. Okay, that's correct. And she did send her friend Sarah to go get his bags and bring them back. What we have in addition to that is her statement that Sarah testified to DJ saying, take him home, meaning my client home. We have, she said, I never want to talk to you again, but many of the witnesses that were at the bar testify that he's trying to get her attention. Please, I just want to talk to you. I just want to talk to you. Finally, he leaves. And he starts this round of text messages, and I think that's really what the evidence is of giving permission, because I think you can infer permission. She said, I don't want to talk to you, but she's still communicating either, we don't know what messages, some of the messages she responded to, but she gave the phone to DJ. He never let my client know that it was him at the other end of the phone. Some of the text messages clearly indicate that there was a response. And I think what's really important in looking in this is that she saved all of my client's incoming messages and she didn't save any of the responses. None. So we have nothing in the record about what was told to my client. What we do know from her, and she admitted this during her trial testimony, is that late in the evening, around midnight, my client says, well, can I still give your son the iPod I brought for him for his birthday? And she says yes. And she admits that at trial. And in that response, there is implied, okay, we are going to have to see each other again. She didn't give any specifics. So I do. I think that there's evidence in the record to support an inference of permission. But the issue is really, we wanted that instruction also on possessory interest, because she's not the only one that could grant permission, at least in my opinion, into that residence.
Can I ask you to tell us the case you're relying upon to say that a person who has been staying in a home for 3 days as a house guest has a possessory interest sufficient for that individual to grant permission?
Well, I think there's a whole body of case law, which I've cited, saying that a person with possessory interests can grant permission. I haven't found any cases that say there's a time limit on that. That's a question of fact for the jury to decide. That's what the Waddell case says, or the Hollenbeck case, I'm sorry, says that, you know, whether there is a possessory interest is a question of fact for the jury.
Well, counsel, all the cases that talk about possessory interest do so in the context of persons who have, when it says interest, they mean right, a legal right to possess the premises.
Right.
A tenant, somebody like that.
Right.
Not a house guest. I couldn't find a single example of a house guest having a possessory interest. In other words, it's somebody who has the right to tell somebody else with a possessory interest or an ownership interest, I'm coming over and you can't do anything about it. That's a right.
It is.
Are you saying that there's evidence that DH or DJ had that right?
Well, I think he did. He had been living there going on 4 days, okay? He had his own set of keys to her house. So he came and went as he pleased. He testified that he used her car pretty much the whole day until they went to pick my client up at the bus station. Again, if I have a friend that comes over to my house for 2 hours, and somebody comes to my house and they let them in to do something, do they have the right to do that? It's not something maybe we've talked about before, but if I'm letting them stay in my house, I think they have a right to let people in my house or not as they see fit.
Well, the question is, do they have a possessory interest? You're getting ahead of yourself. You have to have a possessory interest first before they can have the right to let somebody in. That was the instruction that was requested. So
right.
Are you saying that if I stay at my friend's house for 3 days, he can't kick me out unless he commences formal eviction proceedings?
Oh, no. Because he can kick you out, yes.
Well, then how do I have a possessory interest in the house? I don't have any legal right to be there. That's what you just said. The owner can tell me to get out.
But the owner here didn't tell DJ to get out. What she said is, you have permission to be here. You have permission to spend the night. You have permission to stay here. I'm giving you a set of keys to my house. My house is yours for the time that you're staying here. So he has, I think, a possessory and occupancy interest. I mean, what the courts say, the Colorado Supreme Court and different divisions of this court have said, is that the focus is on possession, the possessory interest, the occupancy interest, not ownership. It is not the owner that is the sole person.
Those are Fourth Amendment cases. Those are cases discussing whether an individual has standing to object to a search of the premises. And you don't have to be an owner, obviously, to do that. You can be an occupant of the premises to do that. That's what those cases are talking about. But this is different. The language here in the instruction is requested as a possessory interest.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the cases talk about possessory interest in terms of legal rights. Legal rights. apply to tenants.
Well, right, but...
Tenants have legal rights. They don't own the place. They have the legal right to be there, and they have the legal right to exclude others from being.
But I think he did have the legal right to be there. Nikki, the victim, gave him that legal right to be here, and she didn't put any restrictions on who he, that are in the record anyways, on who he could and couldn't let in. He had his own set of keys. He had the legal right to be there. I don't think there's anything in the cases, and I'm not relying on Fourth Amendment cases. I'm relying on the Bearfield case, which is the janitor that clearly could come into the office building but could be excluded from the individual office within that building if he had knowledge, which he did with the sign on the door. I'm talking about the Johnson case, the estranged couple, and the wife moved into a different apartment that the husband was never on the lease. And so just by virtue of their legal marriage, that does not give him a possessory interest, but he had to know that he couldn't be there. So I'm not relying on Fourth Amendment cases. There's the Bearfield case, there's the Johnson case, there's the Hollenbeck case, which is, again, estranged spouses, and the wife is in the house and she gets a restraining order and changes the locks. And, you know, that's the case that says whether there's a possessory interest isn't tied to some legal right, no legal document. It's, do the facts show that that person had a possessory interest? And that is a, that's a jury question. And which I think leads to the jury question, because I think that the jury thought that he probably may have had, that was the question they had. Could he let my client in? And there's nothing in the record to show that he couldn't.
What evidence is there in the record that he did?
There is evidence of their relationship, okay? They knew each other previously. They worked together. He testified that they maintained contact with each other. They were partying with each other at her house. He knew that my client had stayed there on previous occasions. And so that's the evidence, you know, that we argued these inferences can be made that DJ was the one that let him in. I don't think that the statement that my client makes to the victim was offered for the truth. I don't think it's self-serving hearsay. I think the prosecutor had to answer the jury's question about why the victim didn't call the police immediately, why she called DJ. And so that it was offered for that purpose and not for the truth. So I don't think that that was self-serving hearsay. But there was evidence in the record, and he lied about it. I mean, his credibility was at issue. He had a burglary conviction. He knew he couldn't say, oh, yes, I gave him permission. This woman was letting him stay in her house. So he had a lot of motives to say that he didn't grant permission, and I think that's what we questioned in our closing argument when we went after his credibility and her credibility. So when the jury asks this question, I think the law is very clear. The jury narrows the legal issue down to possessory interest. We ask for an instruction answering that question, defining what the possessory interests are. And I think the Leonardo case, the Orem case, is also an unlawful entry case. I think the judge at that point had a duty to instruct the jury, because the instructions as they existed didn't answer that question, who? Who could give permission? And that was an issue raised by the evidence in the case. And so I think for that reason, when you look at the jury instructions as a whole, they didn't adequately instruct the jury on who had permission, which is what the defense raised. So I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal and ask you to reverse Mr. Green's convictions. Thank you.
Mr. Yazdi, if you'd like to address the audience and give them a brief overview, that'd be fine with us.
Good afternoon. My name is Majid Yazdi. I'm the Director of the Appellate Division at the Attorney General's Office. This is a factual background that I've been calling the Janice Friars prayer provider. As you will hear from the oral argument, the main issue that we have is the nature of the evidence presented at trial and the arguments made below that affects the resolution of the legal issues presented, which Ms. Breyer described. So I'm going to limit to that. As my argument will explain, we have responses to points that are raised.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Majid Yazdi, representing the people in this case. As I have argued in the answer brief, the main issue here is whether there was evidence for the court to grant the request for the instruction. The only evidence that is relied on in the opening brief is, and of course below when the argument was made to the court, was a self-serving hearsay statement made by Mr. Green to the victim. When the victim, made through DJ to the victim. When the victim contacted DJ, and informed DJ of the presence of the defendant in her house, she asked DJ, "Did you let him in? Because that is what he says." We don't have anything else in the record. Of course, the defendant did not testify. We don't have any evidence in the record other than that self-serving hearsay to indicate that DJ somehow, without the victim's knowledge, authorized the defendant to enter the house. And that is why in the closing arguments, the whole argument was based on whether the victim was being credible when she said that she had not authorized the DJ and the defendant, that she had not authorized the defendant to enter the house, because there was testimony by a friend of the victim to the effect that the victim had authorized DJ to let the defendant in. So the question was before the jury, as argued by by defense counsel, was whether the victim was truthful in her testimony when she said she did not authorize the defendant to enter her house and she did not ask DJ to let him in. That was the argument. There was never an argument whether DJ, independently of the victim, had any rights or did in fact actually do that, and whether that was within his rights or not. So the whole question of the possessory right of DJ is irrelevant to this case because it was not based on evidence, and I mean credible evidence, and it was not based on any arguments presented to the court. And that is why the court properly said, based on the facts presented in this case, this is not a correct instruction to give, because courts are not authorized to give general instructions on principles of law when the facts do not justify giving that instruction. The instruction that was being asked by the by defense counsel was about possessory rights of DJ and whether it was withdrawn or not, another issue that was not raised by the facts of this case. As far as the question of whether he was authorized to be there or not, it is clear. The facts indicate that she told him to get his stuff and, in fact, did not even allow the defendant to go to the house to get his personal belongings. Someone else went to get the belongings of the defendant, brought it back to the restaurant where they were meeting at that time, and by having even someone else return the items, it was clear that the victim had no interest in maintaining any further contact with the defendant. And at 2:45 p.m., 2:15, 45 minutes before the victim discovered the defendant, surprisingly, in her house, the defendant sent an email asking, "Is there a shelter I can go to?" So it is clear that the defendant was knowledgeable about the intent and the desire of the victim.
Mr. Yazdi, taking your opponent's side for the purposes of discussion, she would say there was lots of discussion back and forth about whether he was permanently excluded from her life, if you will. And in the ordinary course of human experience, people change their minds frequently, particularly when they're involved in a romantic relationship. They have arguments, they disagree, they make up, they have fallings out, and your opponent argues that there's evidence that they continue to communicate. What do you do with that?
Again, Your Honor, that question, in a sense, is irrelevant to the issue raised here, because the issue raised here is whether DJ had possessory rights and whether the jury had any right to know about this legal principle and then apply to the facts of this case. If the argument is that the victim somehow changed her mind later on and allowed the defendant to enter, that was not the argument made below. The argument is that, that is not the argument made here, because the argument is that the jury should have been instructed on that legal principle.
And you're saying it has absolutely no relevance as far as it relates to the question of DJ's possessory.
Exactly.
Counsel, you said that the statement by the victim, that the defendant had told her that DJ let her in was self-serving hearsay. But my reading of the record shows that the statement was not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. That would make it perhaps self-serving, but not hearsay.
My point is that whether it was admissible or not, that's a separate issue. My point is that in terms of credibility of that statement, that is a self-serving statement. It is hearsay because it was a statement made by the defendant outside of the trial, and the defendant did not testify.
But the statement was offered to show the effect on the victim's state of mind and why she did what she did. It wasn't offered for the truth of the matter.
But if it is treated as for the truth of the matter, then that would make it a hearsay statement. That is what the argument is now, that it is the truth of the matter that needs to be considered. So if it is taken for that purpose, then it would become a hearsay statement.
But it was one elicited by the prosecution, not by the defense. I mean, so the prosecution elicits a statement from the victim and then wants to say that it's not admissible? That sounds like what you're doing here.
I'm not focusing on the admissibility of the statement itself. I'm questioning, and the issue that I'm raising is that to what extent that evidence is credible to justify giving the instruction. And because it is a self-serving statement made by the defendant outside the court and conveyed, presented to the jury through the testimony of the victim, that is a statement that is not credible.
But doesn't the jury determine credibility? The judge doesn't determine credibility. We don't determine credibility. Isn't it up to the jury to decide whether that's a credible statement?
Yes, Your Honor. The point is that for the court to decide to, based on the evidence presented, whether there is any evidence on the question of possessory right, the court has to decide as a threshold matter if there's credible evidence to give that instruction. And if there's no credible evidence, then the court is not required to give any instruction on that legal principle. So the relationship between the evidence presented and the instruction is what I'm focusing on. Not whether that statement, the jury has the, of course, the right to make a credibility determination, but as a threshold matter, the court has to examine the evidence. And this is what the court said in the order, saying that based on the facts presented, I don't see this instruction as being an appropriate instruction. So my point is the relationship between the evidence presented and the court's ruling on the request for the instruction. If there's not credible evidence for that general principle of law, then the court properly should deny that request.
Another way of articulating that standard is the scintilla of evidence. The court seems to treat those standards as the same.
Yes.
Credible evidence, scintilla of evidence. Scintilla of evidence, very low standard.
But it's still credible evidence. If the evidence is not credible, it is not even a scintilla of evidence to make it justifiable to give that instruction.
So does the judge have to engage in an analysis of whether, as a matter of law, that statement cannot be believed? Is that the test?
Yes, that is true.
Why is that true here? Why, as a matter of law,
was that statement not worthy of belief?
The general principle, again, goes back to the self-serving nature of the hearsay statement, that people, I cite the cases there, that generally the point is that because it allows statements to come in without being challenged, without being questioned, so they are not credible based on the fact that it is not subject to examination, and it's self-serving. It's easy to make self-serving statements, and as a general principle, these statements lack the credibility to make them adequate to provide the evidence of evidentiary basis for the instruction. And the court, again, if we include in the analysis the argument made by the defense in the closing argument, the argument was not that that DJ somehow was, you know, authorized to let the defendant in. That was not the argument. The closing argument focused on the evidence presented, and the evidence that the defense wanted to challenge was the testimony by the victim here, who denied giving authorization to the defendant.
Mr. Yazdi, but to be fair, the defendant couldn't make the argument about possessory interest because the court didn't give the instruction. So the defendant wouldn't be permitted to make the argument that there was a possessory interest and he had authority to allow defendant to enter without a jury instruction telling him they could consider that. So it's cart before the horse kind of argument. I mean, the fact that they didn't make the argument just means that they did the best that they could with the instructions the court gave.
I agree that that could be another explanation for the argument made in the closing argument. I'm not relying only on that, just reinforcing the argument that because the evidence was insufficient to support the instruction, and because it was not a credible evidence to give any instruction on the issue of possessory rights. Unless the court has any question, we ask the court to affirm defendant's judgment.
Thank you.
Just a couple points briefly. I disagree. I don't think that the trial judge should be making assessments of credibility of the evidence and deciding whether to give an instruction. The cases that talk about scintilla of the evidence in the context of a defense theory case say the defendant's entitled to the instruction no matter how absurd the defense may be. So the court doesn't make a credibility determination, I don't believe. The court looks at the evidence that's been adduced at trial to make that determination, and I think there's sufficient evidence here. And insufficiency, this whole idea of insufficiency was not really argued below. I mean, the court found it could be argued either way. The court made legal rulings saying it's covered by the instruction and the proposed instruction doesn't correctly state the law. And I think those were errors. So I would ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will likewise stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course. We will take a recess momentarily. We ask counsel if they can to stay and speak with the students. We will be back in about 15 minutes. We'll be happy to talk with the students about the arguments, but not in terms of the cases themselves. We can talk about style, we can talk about preparation, but we won't talk about the cases. So with that, we'll be in recess in the bailiff day.